This is Jeff Chrisman, and I'm here this afternoon at Living Arts, and I'm visiting with artist Cynthia Ann Brown. Cynthia, thanks so much for taking the time to visit with
me
today.
Thank you for asking me to come in.
Absolutely. I thought what we might do, and of course, I am definitely very interested to hear about, you know, not only your work and your process, but it would also be very interesting to learn about more about you as a human being. But I thought what I might do, just for the benefit of listeners, would be to actually just ask you to share a little bit just about, if someone were to ask you about your work, maybe just to hear a little bit about what you would share with them.
Okay, well, I'm a painter, and it's my passion, and I feel like I'm living the dream right now because I've been able to be a full-time painter for the past 7 years, and it's just been really fun to explore my passion and just get lost in what I do and, you know, allow myself to be open to whatever happens. I don't plan or have preconceived ideas, and whatever I paint is generally just moment to moment, spontaneous, no plan. So, I don't know.
I appreciate that. And I was going to ask you too, and of course I've always been very intrigued by the process of creating abstract works, and of course, you know, not being an artist and not understanding anything in terms of how that is done or the theory or the approach behind that. I guess I would almost ask you, maybe even spiritually or psychologically, if there is you know, how you find that affects you, you know, kind of creating things in the moment.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Well, it is a very spiritual thing, and it's a quiet and contemplative practice, and very reflective and also mysterious. You know, it's the one practice that, I mean, even though I have an MFA and a BFA and I've studied art and I've been making art my whole life, it still is elusive to me, and I don't necessarily have the answers, but it's just more like diving into the unknown and figuring out moment to moment what happens. You know, I get the painting started. A lot of times I'll embed my hopes or prayers, dreams, whatever I've got to embed into that painting. Sometimes I'm feeling rage or fear, whatever it is. I'll just write about it and put it in that painting and then just start working on it. So there's a feeling and depth to it. And it's also, it's just like a moment to moment. So like if I start a painting on a Wednesday, there's the recording of my however many hours I worked. There's the reflection of the movement, the energy, the dance that I do when I paint, all of that. Then the next day, normally if I try to work on that painting again, the mood is going to change. Everything's going to look a little different about it. So a lot of times I'll try to work, not always, but sometimes a la prima, which is wet on wet, where I start the painting and I complete it in one, not sitting, I stand to paint, but I'll complete it in one session and then not touch it the next day, because it definitely does change.
And it's so interesting. I never thought about that before, as far as it's almost kind of like, would it be kind of almost like a snapshot of a particular point in time, or maybe a particular day that you're working on?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, and it's hard, you know. Sometimes I'll try to go back to a painting, and if it's got an integrity of its own, it's speaking to me, it's got a voice, I'll try to give it that voice. And if it's something that's like, it looks like an animal that needs to be put out of its misery, I'll make some really big, decisive moves on it and just drastically change it, annihilate it, and then start the whole process again.
Very interesting, very interesting. And I was going to ask as well, do you ever have times where maybe let's say for instance, you wake up on a given day and you're going to start working on something, is it always clear to you, if someone were to ask you, you know, Cynthia, how are you feeling today? Are there ever any days that maybe defy? I've always wondered about that from the standpoint of an artist creating work. Are there some days where maybe is it hard to actually say exactly, you know, what emotion you might be feeling, but yet you find that you can actually, something on the canvas is allowing
right.
you to communicate that?
Yeah. A lot of times just getting into the studio, I'll sometimes procrastinate because I'm not feeling inspired or whatever, but I find that if I can just get into that studio and just be in there. Maybe I'm just saging the space or getting my music on or looking at what I did yesterday while I'm dancing around or whatever, you know, because I move a lot when I paint. And generally it'll draw me in, and I just get in there, and next thing I know, a lot of time has passed. And I'm not saying that I always know what kind of emotion I'm feeling, but whatever it is, I'm there in the moment and get lost. The time kind of stands still, you know.
And then as far as I never thought about this before, but it's interesting when you know, using the word procrastination, I'm wondering in some ways is that, and I know sometimes when we say the word procrastination and we or other people tend to look at that as we're avoiding starting something, or there's kind of this tendency to avoid something. I'm also wondering, do you ever find that sometimes whatever is being done in those moments of what you refer to as procrastinating, that there's something that actually feeds ultimately what you're doing once you do get started? I'm just kind of wondering if there's any, not necessarily trying to glorify it or not glorify it, but I'm just kind of wondering, is that part of the process?
Well, I'd say when I'm in there and I'm tooling up, as I call it, where I'm washing the brushes and cleaning up the mess from the day before, that's part of my process, is to get into the groove and the mood. If I left the studio a mess yesterday, just to get in there and start washing up, straightening, creating some order so that I can work and create some chaos again, you know. But I also have to say, I had a 3-year fellowship with the Tulsa Artist Fellowship. So in that case, I would, pack my lunch and leave the house by 8:30 or 9 and go up there and work. And so it was a different kind of procrastination. You know, maybe I'd go visit with my friend down the hall or whatever, you know, do some kind of procrastination in a different way. But now I have a home studio. I work at home, and so it's like, it's not always inspiring, but I mean, the laundry calls, the dog is wishing to be walked, all that kind of stuff, you know. The dishes need to be done. So I find that since I've got all day, I work at my home studio, that I don't quite focus on that studio work as intensely. It's more like, oh, I'll go in here and work for a little while, and then I go in here and do the dishes and sit down and read a cup, you know, have a cup of tea and, you know, whatever. So I feel like I'm not quite as intensely focused as I was in my downtown studio, because I've got a lot of distractions.
Yeah, that's another thing too, is I'm kind of thinking in the moment too, having a place to work like that in the home. I'm wondering if sometimes that it becomes more than just another, you know, more than just another room, so to speak. If there's, I don't know necessarily. I've always wondered if people who work in home studios, is there some energy maybe that reaches you from there? Let's say, for instance, if you're in another room, and this is just me kind of in the moment wondering about that. As someone who works at home, but I do very different work than something creative.
Yeah.
I was just always wondering maybe what that feels like in terms of, you know, all of the your supplies are in there, the canvases.
It's, but then delicious. I love knowing that it's in there. You know, it's really comforting to know that, like, it's the other day it snowed, and it was early in the morning. I normally don't paint that early in the morning, but I just wandered in there and started piddling around. Next thing I know, I'm working, and it's still dark outside, you know. So yeah, having it at home definitely is it's enticing, you know. And what we did was we turned our whole front area into my studio space. It's all got glass, and you know, I've got a lot of room to work, and my husband's got his office in there, and we've got a big table where we can communally work as well. So it's like, finally, our house feels like it's really like we really need it to be, which is a place to live back there in the back, and here's where we do all of our work up front here, you know.
I like that.
So it's awesome. I love it.
Do you ever have times where you maybe just will go in there just to kind of absorb or just take in what it is that you've done?
Yes.
Maybe you're not actively creating, but just kind of spending some time there.
Yeah, I love to do that. Just sit and gaze, and I have a little cozy spot in my studio where, you know, I can just sit there and ruminate, look at what I'm working on. And it's nice, you know. It's really vital. I have to have it.
I like that. And then I was going to, I guess, shifting gears a little bit to ask you a little bit about, and of course, there again, I would like to ask about, you know, your evolution as an artist over the years. And so I'm thinking logically, maybe it makes sense to kind of start at the beginning, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Maybe just understand a little bit about how you got started creating artwork, maybe some early inspiration, certain artists that spoke to you maybe, and just maybe kind of starting there and then just kind of moving forward if there are different distinct periods, in the work that you've done.
Sure. Well, as a young child, I did want to be an artist. And I used to get up on Saturday mornings when I was like 4 or 5 years old. Nobody else was awake yet. And this was back in the early 50s. And I would put this little plastic screen that we could put on our black and white TV, tape it up there, and it had, you know, red, yellow, and blue. So it'd make it kind of a color TV. So I'd tape that thing up there and watch Jonathan Nagy give these drawing lessons on Saturday morning. And so I did that on my own, and I was always doing all kinds of other creative things, although I had no art classes. So I was always like going out in the woods and creating hideouts in the vines and weaving things together and making all kinds of spaces and burying stuff and doing ceremonies and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was a creative kid with no art classes. And then this was in North Tulsa. Then we moved to Pryor, Oklahoma when I was in fifth grade, and we had horses and woods and creeks and all that kind of stuff. But again, no art. And so I was into riding my bike, my horses and all that kind of stuff, and still doing creative things, but I didn't think about art anymore back then. I did draw horses all the time. Anyway, when I came back to Tulsa, sophomore year of high school, I came back to Tulsa and still didn't take art classes. They had art then, but I didn't even think about it because I'd forgotten about it, kind of. And so then around in my early 20s, I met a guy who was an artist. He was a painter, and he was my boyfriend for like 4 years. And so he is really, Wyatt was his name, and he was one of the main inspirations that reminded me, when you were a kid, you wanted to be an artist. You forgot all about that. So I started painting then, and this was in the mid-70s, and started taking classes, one class at a time, to get my associate's degree, and then finally I got my bachelor's of fine arts from TU. And I didn't have parental support, or I was an older student because I couldn't afford to go to college and all that stuff. So I got my painting degree in 1985 from TU, and my paintings still were terrible. I wanted to be a painter really badly, and my paintings sucked. So I was, I always had jobs. I was designing windows, creative jobs, making the store look beautiful, and window dresser and all that stuff. And then I started taking ceramic classes, and I was good at it and sold my work and got into all these shows, and people were wanting me to make more stuff. So next thing I know, I'm a ceramic artist for 20 years, and I made large sculptures and goddesses and female torsos and all kinds of stuff like that. And then I made cats with real whiskers and all kinds of stuff. Then I got my MFA in ceramics from TU in 2001. And after that, I started teaching high school art because I thought I would teach college, but I did teach at TU for adjunct, but I couldn't live on that. So I started teaching high school art. And that's really where I really felt like I gained a lot of confidence in my art, understanding art for real, because I was teaching it. So I finally understood what the elements and the principles of art were and how those are the artist's tools. Instead of your visual vocabulary, these are your talking vocabulary. This is your visual vocabulary: line, shape, color, texture, all that, whatever the other one is, value. So I felt like I really got a grip on art, and I made art the whole time. I taught painting and ceramics, sculpture, 2D and 3D design, all that stuff. And then after 10 years of teaching, they were trying to force me to teach middle school, which I despised. So my husband told me I could stop teaching. And I was almost at retirement age. And he was like, I'm going to let you live your dream of being a full-time artist for this 1 year. This was in 2013. He's like, I'll work, make, you know, don't worry about the bills. Just see if how you like being a full-time artist. So I painted every day for like 8 hours a day.
Wow. Wow.
And I loved it. I had a studio out behind our house then. It's a detached garage apartment that we turned into a studio. So I was out there painting every day, and really, I really set my mind and my goals to it, making it happen. And it did. You know, I started painting with joy and ease instead of fear, which was something that I dreaded painting because it was bad and I wasn't good at it, and it made me feel worse about myself. So I would just put it off, and I'd suddenly gotten to where I could actually paint, you know. And then I started taking workshops and teaching workshops to adults, and applying for different shows that I got in, getting galleries, selling my work. I had a Santa Fe gallery for a while that did really well with my work, and I'm represented in Tulsa by M.A. Doran Gallery, 35th in Peoria. And I got a 3-week residency in Latvia with the Mark Rothko Contemporary Art Center. And
oh, my goodness.
Some of my work is over there in Latvia. So anyway, I had a great 3 or 4 years of painting. And then I got my Tulsa Artist Fellowship, and that was another kind of feather in my cap. Pretty prestigious thing to have. And now my fellowship is up, and I'm back to working at home and having a blast.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you were talking, I never thought about this before, but in terms of, I guess I didn't have any beliefs that, you know, when an artist gets ready to create art, that you just dive right in and there is no fear. But I am finding it interesting. I don't think I've ever spoken to an artist before about that. So I'm very intrigued to hear a little more about it. Is it something you feel drawn to do, but yet even when you know the fear is there?
Yeah.
I guess I'm just interested to hear a little more maybe about the, as far as the, you know, there is the pull to doing that, and yet maybe there also is the resistance to doing what you're feeling this inner calling to do.
Right.
So I find that really interesting.
Yeah. I do too, really. I think we're, the fear is programmed in because of judgment, self-criticism, and others, what others are going to think, and, oh, I'm not good at this. You know, people expect to be good at stuff like, when they come into an art class, most times they'll say, oh, I'm terrible at art. I can't do art. I can't draw a stick. Well, it's like when you go into a French class, can you speak French? No. You're here to learn some stuff.
Yeah.
So, but the fear, I don't really have fear anymore because I've come to embrace and realize part of my process is that paintings go through ugly stages, and I don't know what the answers are, you know? It's like, I don't like that. This is the part I don't like, so I'm going to get rid of it. You know, make that decision. Okay, now what I'm going to do? Do something else. But instead of being fearful about it or feeling like, you know, I'm threatened as a human being by these decisions I'm making on a canvas, it's really just kind of ridiculous. So through the years, I've just started to embrace the whole process, embrace the not knowing and the ugly phase and, you know, put that judgment to bed, you know. And also, when I was working in 2013, trying to do my full-time work, I had a book, a wonderful book by Flora Boley, and I learned from her that to write mantras on the wall. And so I had all these mantras on my studio walls and even on my mirrors, little tape, you know, yellow pieces of paper up that have, be bold, let go, be brave. I paint with joy and ease. That was a big one. And I said that mantra to myself over and over for probably 2 years. And it finally seeped in. And I do paint with joy and ease now instead of dread and, you know, self judgment and all that kind of stuff.
That is so interesting. And I was going to even ask, do you think it's a situation of maybe because you were doing this daily that you it almost kind of put you, I don't want to use the word forced, but I don't know if that's the right word or not. Did this really put you in a position where you really, in order to keep going and to keep creating, that you had, you felt like you had to deal with that? You had to really push up against that envelope?
I did have to push against it. Yeah, I had to. And, you know, I think words are powerful and thoughts are powerful. And so part of the process I did was not only to repeat that I paint with joy and ease, but to visualize what I want to say out loud to the universe, what it is that I want, to write it down, to think about it. And instead of thinking about, oh, that painting looks like crap or whatever, you know, to be thinking about, I want to get this. Make these beautiful paintings, and I want to have them seen worldwide. Whatever the vision is that I want, whatever it is, I want to make $50,000 this year. Whatever it is, say it out loud.
Yeah.
And keep the mantra, all the mantras that I was repeating, I just keep saying them and believing them and manifesting and visualizing and making stuff happen.
Yeah.
You know, I have this one, I do yoga also with my work, but I have this one sun breath where I visualize gold coins raining down with each breath as I exhale, gold coins and green, all this money just raining down. And I'll write it, like if I'm needing some money, I'll get my gold and green out and embed it in my painting. Draw coins and dollar signs and write about prosperity. Put it in there. Put the intention in there. And it's really, you know, it's worked pretty darn well.
Yeah, and I almost feel compelled to ask you, is this, to a certain degree, when you look at how you changed as a result of pushing up against that resistance and going past it, I don't know if that's the right way to characterize that in words, or that you, you know, you had the opportunity to really to deal with any resistance or fear and go through it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is it possible that this is about more than art, that this is also, I guess I would almost ask you how this has changed your consciousness, or how you have evolved now that you're on the other side of that. And but at the same time, also realizing you were creating works of art during that time that are almost like snapshots or a recording of you going through that process. Just maybe an understanding, if you, not to put you on the spot, but to understand maybe any ways that you think you have changed as a result of going through that process.
Well, I think I've come to realize the power of gratitude and being grateful for what I have instead of, I mean, I do try to manifest things that I want, but I practice gratitude every day for the things that I have. And also, I had one other thing I was going to say. I also have realized that, you know, there's power in words and thoughts. You can think negatively or you can think positively. And I can remember years ago when my husband and I were really, really broke and working really hard. And, you know, I'm teaching school and I'm working another job teaching in Bartlesville for, you know, RSU, driving at night, doing all these things, trying to just make money. And we had no money. We were broke. And we had this mindset of poverty and scarcity, and we were tragically broke, and we were wallowing in it. Do you know what I mean? And somehow, part of it was when I was making ceramics, I came up on this money cat, prosperity cat, that, you know, is in a Chinese laundry and has its paw up beckons in business and abundance.
Yeah.
And when I found out about that thing, this was probably 20 years ago, I started making them out of clay. And I made big ones, little ones, every kind of money cat you could make half ones, busts, the whole things, giant size ones, and they all had real whiskers, and they were quite something. And I made so many and got pretty good at it, to where HGTV in Hollywood came out for a show, That's Clever, and did a story of me making these dang money cats, and I had to make so many of them. That, you know what I mean? But it's like, that was, you know, when I look back, it's like, that was part of the shift of trying to think positive and work with things in a more like a fulfilled, authentic way instead of a place of scarcity and not enough, you know.
Yeah, kind of shifting. It's almost like what they call an abundance mentality, right, versus totally. A scarcity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And gratitude is pretty much responsible for that. Just understanding that to practice gratitude will make you a happier person, make you appreciate things more, and then more of that same comes to you.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I just that I can see here that this is about so much more than just the art itself, that it's also the kind of the feedback that
art is such a metaphor for life, you know, the fact that of detachment, you know, non-attachment. Buddhism talks all about that. And in the way that I paint, you know, I get started, I might have some interesting things going on, but I've got to edit them out and get rid of some things and don't hold on to it. Just because it's a pretty little corner, it might not be working. I've got to be able to let go of it, you know, and move on. Make some decisions. Maybe it's a bad one. Okay. Move on from there. You know.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you bring that up as far as just that they're sort of a Buddhist approach. I was going to say, as someone, not that this is about me, but that has studied that and practiced, you know, many of those things for years, that whole idea of the artist, you know, clean. And so I almost wonder, because I know a lot of those practices are about letting go, non-attachment, not clinging to an ego, or even thinking of ourselves as who we think we are, or maybe identifying with what we're doing in terms of our work. But I'm wondering if in some ways, did you find those things to be really beneficial? I guess I would almost ask you just to kind of maybe take a look at those, just those teachings that you studied and applied, you know, in terms of, you know, whether it was, you know, just any kind of Eastern practices, whether it's Buddhism or whatever it is. And I always find this, since that's something that's always been of interest to me, maybe hearing how you, and it sounds like you've already, and I appreciate you've already shared quite a bit in terms of how that has helped, but I didn't know if there's anything else that you might want to add as far as just how that's benefited you or your process or your art.
Well, I started doing yoga back in the early 70s, and I taught myself from books. Back in the day, there weren't yoga places all over, you know, America like there are now. And eventually I did get certified as a yoga teacher, as you know, like it was only in 2007 when I did it. And I did it then so I could incorporate yoga into my high school art classes. And, you know, the classes I teach now, sometimes I'll incorporate it. And I still practice yoga. And so I already had that kind of Eastern philosophy, you know. And I've done Tai Chi and, I don't know. I'm not really a religious person, but if I'm any religion, it would be Buddhist. I have studied some Buddhism. But I do like to practice the non-attachment and a lot of the other just simple Buddhist teachings that, I don't know, probably do affect my work. I don't know. I don't think I answered your question very well.
Oh, no. I appreciate it. That was great. And there again, I had no expectations.
Yeah.
There again, another one of those practices, expectations about any particular answer.
Yeah. Well, I do meditate, or I have been known to meditate. I haven't been doing it lately, but for a few years I did. And I also practice Kundalini yoga, and that's where you focus a lot on the third eye. And a lot of times I will be in a Kundalini class and see these visions, and like I can't wait to get out of class and get home and try to, not that I really try to paint what's up there, but I just feel inspired by the colors that I see, and I just want to get home and put it down while it's fresh.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I was going to ask too, as far as the fear, there's one of the things that I had, and I apologize, it's kind of now coming back to me.
Sure.
When you were talking about as you were you know, creating a work, and maybe if you were not happy with something that you were seeing on the canvas, were there times where maybe was it a matter of maybe thinking or feeling like and thinking that other people maybe were going to feel negatively about it? Or was it really more just about, I mean, in terms of when you talk about the judgment, for instance, is that really about thinking that maybe other people are going to look at that and think something? And I don't know if maybe that's a fair, I don't know if that's a fair question or not.
Yeah.
But I just find that whole process interesting as far as when we see something that we're creating and then there's a tendency to maybe not like it.
Yeah.
Wondering maybe is some of that because we're maybe projecting or thinking that other people will not like it.
Yeah.
And then judge you accordingly,
right.
or is it part of some of that also judging yourself
Yeah.
Maybe are your expectations.
All of the above. Yeah.
Sorry, I know that was kind of a load. I know that was a very loaded question.
I think before I forget, the main thing problem that I find with all that thinking, and I can go back to it, but I'm going to forget this. The way to rectify all that is to make lots of work for me.
Oh,
you know, have lots of work. And like when you think of somebody prolific like Picasso, he had thousands and thousands of works of art. They weren't all masterpieces. Mm-hmm. He made a lot of work, you know, and so I think that's the thing. It's like when you are first starting out painting, or when I was first starting, I would try to place too much preciousness on each thing I made.
Oh,
you know, it's like, oh my God, I've worked on this for the whole semester, and I hate that part right there, but I can't help it. You know, it's, you know what I mean? It's like now I realize what I should have done is work in a series or have lots of starts so that I can have a lot of energy and a lot of things going. And when I get stuck on this one, throw it aside, do some more stuff on this one, put it aside. So you got some stuff to go back and forth with, and you don't get stuck and work something to death, you know? I had some more things to say about that, but I forgot what they were.
Yeah, as far, and the other thing that leads me to asking sometimes is that I know there's a tendency as human beings, we want to kind of work in a linear fashion, like I start this and then I'm going to finish this.
Uh-huh.
But then I'm wondering sometimes, do you kind of have to let that, it kind of sounds like what you're saying is in some cases you just had to let that go.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe set something aside.
Oh, yeah.
And then allow yourself to kind of shift your focus. And
heck yeah. Right now I just had a closet built out in the back studio, and the whole closet is full of paintings. Some of them are finished. But a lot of them are paintings that I just abandon. That it's like, I've worked on this and I still don't like it. It's not worthy of showing in a gallery or varnishing or putting hardware on. It's not worthy of that. But I'm just going to put it there, and someday I'll either go back to it or I will just paint over it and start it again or something, you know. So, I mean, I have a lot of things that are, you know, they're not satisfactory, and either maybe I give up on them or go back to them another day or whatever. But I don't trip about it.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, too, is that a way of kind of like letting go of judgment by instead? Because I realize that one thing would be to just, to feel like, I don't want to deal with this ever again. I'm going to get rid of this. I find it really interesting, and I like the idea of just, you know, having a place that you can set it aside, but maybe that it's somewhere that's kind of away from view.
Yeah.
So that you don't necessarily, I mean, it's still, nice. You know, they're still there, but you don't necessarily have to. Yeah.
You don't have to deal with them anymore. Get them out some other rainy day.
Yeah, and then is it possible too? Maybe in some way psychically, is that kind of a way of leaving the door open, where maybe you're not necessarily saying,
yeah,
I'll never work on that one again, but you're just kind of leaving the door
kind of
cracked open, maybe to a certain degree.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then I was going to ask too, kind of take a look at, if I understand you correctly, you did teach for a good number of years. And so I thought I would ask you too, just as what the experiences were like, and maybe how, if any, I guess I could ask you first of all, you know, what that was like for you overall when you look back at that period of time now, and maybe asking any formative lessons learned through the process, and maybe how that changed you in terms of just your work as a teacher.
Well, it definitely fits into my gratitude prayer every day that I don't have to do it anymore. Because when I started teaching, you know, I'm not a real organized person, and I live a lot of my life up here in my head. And so when I got my first high school teaching job, I was 50 years old, which is old to start teaching. And I was at Booker T. Washington High School, which was one of the top high schools in the nation at the time. And I had 180 students a day. And I mean, six classes a day of 180 students. And I mean, it was more than, I did a good job at it, but I don't know how I did it. Because back then, I didn't even know how to do email or computers, and I had to take my attendance online. This was in 03 when I started. And I mean, I was totally out of my league trying to do all that stuff. And I did do a pretty badass job of being a teacher there for 3 years. And then I had the opportunity to go to Project 12, which is an alternative school where kids have trouble, they're failing in regular schools. They've got to have, they're at risk. They got to have help and be in smaller classes. So I went there specifically because small class sizes worked for me. Instead of having 30, 35 kids in a class, I had 12 in a class for a longer period of time, and it worked great for my way of thinking because, you know, I like to be able to have things out, get going, and get into a groove and let it flow. And whereas at Booker T, it was like, get everything out, give the lesson, get them all to work, and then, oh my God, we've got like 10 minutes to put it all away. And they were all of them like, where should I put my work? Where's my stuff from yesterday? It's like, hell, I don't know. You know, it was like crazy because I couldn't be in charge of where they put their stuff. They had to do it on their own. So it worked really well for me to go from that big school to a smaller school. And it, you know, I'm the kind of person that likes to go be isolated and work. I'm great at being a studio artist. I like being alone in my head, and I can entertain myself. I never get bored. So here I am teaching every day and having all these kids that need all the stuff and constantly asking me questions and 5 minutes in between class to go to the bathroom, and then one of them's there eating lunch with me at my desk, and I never had 1 minute the whole time. And so it was a blessing when they forced me to start teaching middle school because it drove me completely insane, and my blood pressure was high, and it was making me a nervous wreck. And so then that was my last year in 13 of May when I stopped. Then when school started again in September, they're like, oh, you're doing it again. It's like, oh, no, I'm not. I'm gone. I'm out.
That's the end of that. Huh?
And so it helped me in my gratitude prayers and my beauty about my life of being able to realize every day, realize the gorgeous opportunity to be an artist in a quiet space that gets to work on her own and that gets to have her own thoughts and be with all these beautiful supplies that I love and not have 180 kids going, what are we doing today? Where's my thing from yesterday? Blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just like, it made me just really nervous.
Yeah. You know? Do you see that as part of, I mean, are there any regrets, or do you see this as just part of your journey?
Oh, it's part of my journey. I don't really regret it. It made me a great teacher. I mean, it taught me how to teach. And it was an eye-opening experience in the fact that, you know, I got grabbed by my neck and thrown against the wall and had all my things, all the ceramics that we made, kids would destroy. They would tear up the tools and throw things away and lie and cheat and steal my cell phone and hit each other and murder animals. And I mean, I had some rough students at Project 12,
oh,
let me
my
tell
goodness.
You. So it was really, really, I don't say I regret it, but it was an eye-opening experience to see how bad public schools are. And now it's even worse. That I quit in 13, and my friends who are still there now say, oh girl, you thought it was bad then? You ought to see it now. And that goes back to my Lost in Oklahoma.
Yes.
Which is, yes. Lost in Oklahoma is a song by Hank Williams III.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. And I was wondering where that came
it's
from.
It's a great song. And I listen to music always when I paint. But I had a show at the Capitol of like 30 paintings at the State Capitol building. And I entitled my show Lost in Oklahoma, specifically because of I was hoping I might, you know, make a few, like maybe Inhofe, wonder why I would feel lost in Oklahoma. Why would our senators think that things are messed up here? You know, look at the governor. We didn't have Stitt then. We had Mary Fallon. But anyway, I just think Oklahoma is traditionally backwards, and I love my state. I love Tulsa. I love where I'm from. It's my home. But I think it's we have dismal conditions with the public schools and the way that they, you know, they treat minorities, and you know, there's not enough diversity in Oklahoma, and there's just a lot of problems with Oklahoma. I've lived here all my life, so it's not as obvious to me. But like being in Tulsa Artist Fellowship, all the diversity in that program, they helped open my eyes to see, wow, there is a lot of stuff going on here that is wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
And I wonder, too, is it, when you say lost in Oklahoma, is it really the idea there? Is this really kind of from the perspective not only of you, but you as the as an artist? I didn't want to make any assumptions, but
well, I mean, I think with social media, I have a pretty good ability to be seen worldwide.
Right.
So I don't feel so lost in that regard. I wouldn't really want to be in New York City.
Yeah.
Or you know, or whatever. But I feel, I don't know, the fact that all my life I didn't have art classes. You know, I no telling what kind of an artist I might have been if I'd had art classes growing up. But we didn't have that. We did not have that here. And especially, I grew up in North Tulsa. You know, the fact is there's so much inequality. I live in North Tulsa. You go out south, they've got barriers to keep the sound down from the freeway, and they've got great schools. They've got places to shop. Over here, we don't even have a grocery store. You know, so I don't know. There's just a lot of things wrong that Hank Williams 3 song I love, Lost in Oklahoma, but it also fits the way I feel about being here in a way.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I apologize, when I was asking about as far as feeling lost in Oklahoma as an artist, I wasn't necessarily speaking of you personally.
Right.
But I was kind of talking more about the idea of, in terms of the population as a whole,
right,
in terms of maybe the support support and or lack of support, right, for the arts itself, or
yeah,
maybe just the lack of awareness on some people's part to even be, you know, to even know whether a
yeah
place like this exists.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, every time I vote, my vote really doesn't even count.
Mm.
You know, I vote Democrat always, and I am a blue dog Democrat. And so is my husband, and so are all my friends. But yet, we live in a red state that our voice doesn't matter. You know, I mean, Inhofe just last week's like, I don't see any problem with Trump. I mean, you know, he didn't do anything wrong. So we are normalizing and just, I don't know. I don't know what's happening in the world right now. I don't know. But I feel really upset by it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and I was going to ask too, as far as, you know, just, you know, when you are in your studio working more in isolation, or kind of, you know, doing your thing, and as you say, kind of living your life of the mind, do you find that even though that's the case, it sounds like though that you're still very well aware of what's going on outside that
yeah
door, or, you know, outside that studio?
Yeah, I read the paper and
yeah
all that. I know what's going on, but I'm pretty good at escapism. I've, you know, practiced smoking herb for decades, and you know,
yeah,
I don't let things like that bother me, because I mean, I know I do what I can. I mean, I've marched with the women, and I do what I can, make art about it once in a while. But you know, I'm old, and this is kind of a cop out, but young people can take the reins about all that.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah.
And I was going to ask you, even from the standpoint of Eastern thought and philosophy, at the end of the day, I've always found it interesting, and I'm wondering if you can identify with this at all, that even though there are all these things out in the world that we can get really overwhelmed about and feel like we can't really fix it all, does it really come back to, at some point, what we do with ourselves in terms of within our own minds?
Right. What you fill your mind with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe realizing at some point we kind of do have to retreat.
We do have
and
kind
of stay in our lane and just kind of do what we can do.
Exactly, because otherwise you just make yourself sick. You know, when I'm having a discussion with friends and we get all riled up and heated about politics, things that are happening, you know, I'm usually maybe not always the one, but one of the ones that's reminding everybody that, hey, we've got a good life. You know, we can make beauty here, we can spread kindness in our world, and do the best we can in our community, and hopefully it'll ripple out from there.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever find, as you reflect, or as you maybe look back at your life, you know, when you were teaching and going back in reverse, do you find in some ways, is there a sense of satisfaction that at least, while all the problems couldn't be fixed, as far as all the kids maybe who needed certain things, or the struggles, or the things that were, mm-hmm, you know, unsettling or unnerving, is there some sense, though, that you actually did give a lot of energy and a lot of time to those things?
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention, but I got Teacher of the Year at my school twice, 2 years. And, I mean, I know without a doubt I did a really good job. and I don't have any regrets or any of that. But I mean, I feel good about what I've accomplished in my life, especially when I consider back to when I was in my early 20s. I didn't think I would go to college. Mm. You know, I didn't have any money to go to college, and I didn't have any support from parents or counselors or money or guidance and all that kind of stuff. Nobody had ever gone to college in my family. And, you know, my mother, when my daddy stopped paying child support when I was 18, my mom just said, get the hell out. You know, no plan of what are you going to do or anything. You know, so I had lots of jobs and try to make it, you know, juggle and make a lot of crazy mistakes and have a lot of fun jobs and do a lot of wild things. And I mean, I never thought I would have a master's degree and be teaching people, that's for sure, or having people buy my paintings for thousands of dollars. It never occurred to me back then, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I hate to mention this because I mention it in every interview I have, but I'm still kind of wowed by the fact that I had an eating disorder, which was very debilitating. And I had it from the time I was 19 until I was 39. So 20 years of really, really out of control eating disorder. And even though I did get my bachelor's degree during that time, and I was married a couple times, divorced, and a lot of things happening in there, nobody knew about that eating disorder. And the one constant that I had was art. I made art of, I would always do these self-portraits. And mostly I would do these paintings of myself with a day face on, is what I'd call it.
Hmm.
Because I thought, back then, I thought I was the only person in the world who ate and threw up six times a day, every time, every day, for 20 years. I didn't know there was a name for it, and I didn't know that anybody else did it. And so I felt like I was some kind of, people thought I was really cute and funny and pretty and blah, blah, blah. It's like, if you only knew the monster that lives behind this facade. That's how I felt about myself. And so all these self-portraits that I painted were, I knew what they meant, but nobody else knew what they meant.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and if I understand, basically, when you look at this art, I guess that would be the final question I would ask you. Can you actually see, I don't know, I hope this isn't an unfair question, but do you find that that you see your life journey in each of these works that you look at?
No, these I see moment to moment.
Oh,
the
okay.
The paintings I'm talking about back then were actual self-portraits of me.
Oh, okay.
And they were also, I would paint these jungle scenes and landscapes, woods, with me sitting out there in the woods.
Yeah.
Me sitting on this bank with this river running by. Me with a big scary bird on my shoulder and my hand, which I used. I felt like my hand was a claw. And so it was like this symbolism of, I knew what these portraits meant, but nobody else knew what they meant.
Wow,
so it
yeah.
was realism. I mean, it wasn't abstract. These paintings are totally different than those. Those were context, or they were all about context and content and what, you know, they were telling a story in a different way than these things.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's, and yet I do love that whole idea about these being snapped, because I guess ultimately to have your entire life story, I don't know, this may be a leap, but that it's really made up of, and there again, that may be the kind of that Buddhist thing coming back again,
yeah.
You know, life being a series of present moments. And
yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, are these abstract pieces kind of snapshots?
Yeah,
of all are. The of all these moments that make up your life ultimately.
Yeah, they are. Like I had started the painting I brought today when I was still at Taft, and then I just put it aside. And so yesterday I decided to do an exploration with earthy colors, because I don't use earthy colors simply because that's what we had to use at TU. That's when I was forced to mix all my colors with earthy colors, and I was bored with it. And so now I've done all my neons and all my pinks and greens out of a tube and everything I want to do. So yesterday I was just like thinking, I just want to do an experiment with some earthy colors and some funky mark making and you know, I had some good music on, and so I just riffed on that painting yesterday and had some fun with it, and then decided to call it quits. So, you know, it was kind of like some moments that happened at my studio downtown. And it was a pretty cool painting, but it didn't have enough pizzazz, so I just put it aside. I didn't know what to do to it. So yesterday, I feel like I took that cool beginning that I had from probably 6 months ago in another environment, and I just riffed on it with what I was really passionate about just yesterday. You know?
Yeah.
And so there it is, and I'm done with it. I'm just going to, you know, I have to know when to quit.
Yeah.
So I just need to stop right there and let it be.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, I cannot think of a more fitting way to, it's always interesting. These tend to just kind of come to a natural conclusion. And I have to tell you that, yeah, that it's just, you know, that's, it's kind of like the whole, thing. Here we are, you know, we've kind of arrived at this moment. So yeah, thanks so much, Cynthia. It's really been great visiting with you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I really honor you taking the time.
Thank you, Jeff.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks.